From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan has its first confirmed cases of COVID-19 illness.
The fact is, we know it's out there. This is not the last case.
How far and wide will the spread of this novel coronavirus be? And what sort of social disruption are we facing to try to prevent the spread?
I think now is a very good time for bosses to have conversations with their employees if that trigger is pulled. And I think it's really important to tell people if you're sick or your children are sick, stay home.
And if you hadn't heard among all the other news today, a presidential primary happened here yesterday. Things went pretty smoothly from clerks' perspective. Will that be true in November?
What I imagine is that there will be a lot less downtime on the counting board in November, which means a lot more fatigue and a lot more room for error.
That and more on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. There are now two people who've tested positive for COVID-19 in Michigan. Governor Whitmer declared a state of emergency last night in an attempt to slow the spread of the virus, and universities across Michigan are now suspending face-to-face classes and moving to online instruction. One of the state's two confirmed cases is in Oakland County. It's the second most populous in the state. Dave Coulter is the Oakland County executive, and Dr. Russell Faust is the county's medical director. Gentlemen, thank you both for taking a minute.
Great to be with you.
Dr. Faust, can you tell us what we know about the Oakland County patient at this time?
Well, I can tell you that they're in good shape. They traveled internationally and arrived feeling a little out of sorts, spent a day or two at home, and when they were progressively symptomatic, went to the hospital and were tested. The good news is that there is low to no exposure in the community from this patient, and they're doing well in the hospital now. They're in a negative pressure respiratory isolation room as indicated for coronavirus.
When was this person tested?
They were sampled late Monday night, and they were tested yesterday at the Bureau of Labs, BOL at MDHHS, Michigan Department of Health and Human Services.
And when did the results come in?
Results came in late last night.
It sounded like the person did go to a hospital, at least. Do you have any estimate on how many people may have come in contact with the initial patient?
This person has a spouse, and we are undergoing an active investigation now, a contact investigation. I can't tell you more than that. But they weren't out in the community. So the community is in good shape from this patient.
David Coulter, what are the first steps that the county's taking?
We've been doing a number of things. We activated a task force about 2 weeks ago to begin to daily monitor the situation and coordinate our efforts here. One of the things that we just did this morning is partially activate our emergency operations center. That really just allows us to assist our local partners, coordinate with them, and coordinate our messaging. Because as you can imagine, this is an evolving situation, and the messaging changes. And so this just allows us to coordinate with our partners throughout the county in a more appropriate manner.
Dr. Faust, what is the process for referring and testing patients suspected of having coronavirus? I mean, is the county getting any questions from healthcare providers in Oakland County at this point saying, you know, where do we send the test? What do we do?
You bet. So we've been recommending following CDC guidelines. And those guidelines are that folks that have traveled internationally to those known countries known to have an epidemic, an outbreak of coronavirus, COVID-19, those folks who are known to have been in contact with someone confirmed to have COVID-19, and those folks who are symptomatic. And the triad of symptoms is fever, cough, and shortness of breath. In those circumstances, those folks are appropriate for testing. So what those physicians, those clinics and hospitals are doing is calling us for authorization of testing through state. So that's still required for testing at the Bureau of Labs. That is, we provide, first off, counseling for which patients are appropriate. We don't deny testing of anybody. So it's a clinical judgment. If a clinician decides that they have a patient that's appropriate for testing and they don't meet all CDC criteria, we still authorize testing. We don't, you know, second guess that bedside clinical judgment.
Do you have any sense at this point of how the demand for testing is going, whether the people that you're directing to the state are getting what they need to know in a timely fashion?
Well, we don't direct them to the state. Basically, we authorize the testing and suggest which specimens are required to be sent. And they either send them through us or send them through their courier to Lansing, to the Bureau of Labs, and they go ahead and run the tests. We have had 70 Oakland County residents evaluated for testing, 35 determined not to have the virus, one tested positive, of course, and you're aware of that one. And then we currently have 34 that are under investigation, that is pending testing results.
Right. Do you know if any private labs are helping to pick up some of the work?
Good question. I'm glad you asked. Right now, there is one private lab that I'm aware of that is offering tests in Michigan, and that's LabCorp. There's another private lab that's Quest. Quest is also one of the larger national labs. They're offering tests in a variety of states right now. As of 6 o'clock this morning, I'm not sure what it is right now, but as of 6 this morning, Quest was not yet available as a commercial lab available in Michigan.
Glad to know this. It's not as if the average person is going to walk into one of these lab facilities and get tested, but just so we can get our hands around how these cases are being tracked. Dave Coulter, can you tell us, does the county have any input on whether institutions, whether they're schools or large businesses, decide to shut down or ask people to start doing what they do remotely?
We would certainly make those recommendations, and we evaluate those all of the time. Remember, this I would add is that while this flu is new, our response isn't. We are the public health body in Oakland County that is used to doing these sort of responses. We had a measles outbreak about a year ago that we handled very responsibly in the same sort of manner. And so that includes monitoring the situation, and this one is certainly ever-evolving. And as those kinds of recommendations are warranted, we would make those recommendations to the various institutions. And that's part of the partnerships that I referred to earlier that we're in communication with now.
Do either of you know how many intensive care beds there are in Oakland County's hospitals?
I don't know how many intensive care beds there are. I have a sense of how many respiratory isolation rooms there are in our facilities, and that's somewhere over 30.
Do you have a sense that the hospitals are prepared for what may be coming?
You know, that's a great question. I wish I had a crystal ball. We just don't know what may be coming. I have a sense that our hospitals here in Oakland County are extremely well prepared. That is, emergency preparedness here is really taken to a great level. That includes county health, county overall, as well as our hospitals.
And I would add, we're in daily contact with them, and so we're aware of their needs and their concerns. And at this point, as we continue to monitor this, at this point, we're prepared. But this is an ever-evolving situation, as I mentioned.
Right. And a lot of health providers have suggested that this is not an if, but a when kind of situation. Do you feel confident you have a sense of where to look for the next cases?
I'm not sure where we're looking. Where we'll find the next case is in our community and in those folks that are being tested right now. The fact is, we know it's out there. This is not the last case. And these are not the last cases in Michigan. And, you know, this will be, you know, a wave of infection that sweeps across the United States. But I think we're in pretty good shape in terms of being prepared. We've had some time to see this coming, so I think we're prepared.
What are Oakland County's needs, either from the state or the federal government, right now?
I think it's fair to say more testing kits would be helpful. I know our county board of commissioners has authorized an additional appropriation to purchase those when they become available. I think it's fair to say nationally there's still a need for additional tests. But the other thing that they've been very helpful with is the messaging and the communications. We're in constant communication with the State Health Department and the CDC and others, and so sharing information, sharing best practices of what's working in other parts of the country is certainly helpful to inform the decisions that we make here.
Do either of you know how many kits are available in Oakland County right now?
I don't.
Okay. Dave Coulter, what are you telling people who call the county wanting to know about risk right now?
Well, can I just say that even though it sounds simple, the basic precautions are still the most powerful to slowing the spread, and so that is things like washing your hands frequently, staying home when you're sick, and that doesn't mean just not going to work, but literally staying in your house, stocking up on your medications and food and supplies that you need so that you can stay in the house, keeping distance from other people, especially for those who are high risk, such as older adults or if you have chronic conditions. Those kinds of precautions that we hear a lot about and may sound overly simplistic are frankly still the best remedy at this stage of the virus.
It can't be said enough. I mean, Dr. Faust, how would you characterize the tone of the questions that the county gets from just the general public?
I think it's fear of the unknown, because we really don't have information. You know, we certainly have diseases in the community that have a much higher probability of infecting us and a much higher probability of having a complication and during that infection and even a fatality, something like influenza. And, you know, that kills tens of thousands of people every year in this country. But, you know, what scares people about this right now is the unknown. And, you know, we're still early in that process. You know, for example, we've really had the test in the state of Michigan, a validated test, for a little less than a week now. You know, this is a two-week infection course, so we really don't have the insights yet. And we're still learning a lot nationally and internationally. So I think that's the scary thing. And so that's the tone of calls that we're taking from the public right now.
Dr. Russell Faust is medical director for Oakland County. We've also been speaking with Oakland County Executive David Coulter. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We should add that Quest Diagnostics is now one of two private labs accepting specimens from Michigan for COVID-19 testing. Michigan Radio embedded a reporter at one city clerk's office yesterday for a reporting project that focuses on some of the state's most embattled congressional districts. We'll hear how the counting went among all those piles of absentee ballots in about 10 minutes. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Amid all the news about the coronavirus, it might be easy to forget that a very consequential primary election played out across Michigan last night. And we are looking at the results today with help from Jonathan Kinlock, chair of the 13th Congressional District Democrat for the Democratic Party. He's also third vice chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jonathan, welcome back to Stateside. Good to have you.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Zach Gorchow is here, too, executive editor and publisher of the news service Gong War Michigan. Hi, Zach.
Hello there.
So where were you both on election night? Jonathan, where did you decide to spend your time?
I was stuck right in front of my TV watching the results come in from across the country, but specifically waiting on those results from Michigan.
Very much. Zach, how about you? Where did you end up?
You know, I've got, 40 tabs open on my web browser tracking election results and my computer in the office.
Man, whatever happened to the good old days of watch parties? I kind of miss that.
Well, everybody, it seems like at least I called around to a number of organizations to find out whether or not there were any watch parties. And particularly with the Biden camp, there were no organized watch parties.
Well, that's just sad. Let's get to the results, though. Wayne County went for Joe Biden on a margin of nearly 20 percentage points. I mean, all in all, this was a huge night for Joe Biden in Michigan. But if we talk for a minute just about Metro Detroit, was that surprising to either of you?
Well no. I mean, I think if you look at Oakland, Wayne, Macomb counties, these were counties that Hillary Clinton won 4 years ago over Bernie Sanders. So I think everyone was pretty confident Joe Biden would win those counties. What I think stood out was how much he increased his margins of victory in Oakland and Macomb. dramatically increased them, though Wayne County ended up being closer, actually, than it was 4 years ago.
Yeah. Jonathan, what did you think? Were you surprised by the final tabulations?
Well, not with the Wayne, Oakland, Macomb County, but, of course, you know, throughout this primary season, you had the Bernie supporters pretty much talking about this youth revolution, and you did not necessarily see that in Washington County. So I was surprised that by how many counties the vice president did best Bernie Sanders. So I was, you know, I had a gut feeling that Biden would win, but he really won all of the counties in the state. So that was surprising.
We were taking a look at the election results just within the city of Detroit, though. We haven't been able to get someone on the phone at the clerk's office to confirm with this, but we noticed that there were actually fewer votes cast in the Democratic primary yesterday in Detroit than in the 2016 primary. Jonathan, would that be surprising to you based on what you were seeing in the precincts?
Well, no, but let me say this. Because I kept getting calls from folks, like I said, as chair of the congressional district, asking whether or not we were going to have any GOTV efforts or whether or not we were going to be covering the polls. But the Biden campaign had no paid poll workers out there. So there wasn't a major push from the campaign. These votes that you saw yesterday were organic. They were just, they weren't because of any flushing operations or any of those traditional things that you will see occurring in a general election. So it wasn't a surprise because there wasn't, keep in mind, Biden did not have any money, at least that was spent here in Michigan.
Right. I mean, I guess it was a 5 or 6 person race just days before the Michigan primary. But I mean, you're saying it's not a worry that he hadn't been on the ground in Michigan before this happened?
Well, no, let me say this, not at all, because what this these results say from yesterday in Michigan, as well as what it said across the country, because from what I'm hearing, there wasn't much money spent from the Biden campaign in any of these recent primaries and caucuses, because they basically had few dollars to work with. No, so this here was, you're talking about, some folks was talking about the establishment pushing Biden. No, this is totally folks just going out, knowing what we want to do and what they wanted to do in this election. So it wasn't like it was a lot of money that was spent. On the other, a few weeks ago, of course, there was a lot of money here in the area being spent by Bloomberg. And a lot of folks were leaning towards Bloomberg because the media and a lot of folks thought that Joe Biden's run for the nomination was pretty much done for right mm-hmm. before South Carolina.
Right. Zach Gorchow, you said you'd be keeping an eye on Kent County last night, and wow, what a stunner. You want to recap why you were interested and what ended up happening?
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. So Bernie Sanders defeated Hillary Clinton by about 22-23 percentage points in Kent County 4 years ago. It was a massive number. It was a shocking number, one that I didn't and most did not see coming, and was really indicative of just how much he succeeded outside of Metro Detroit. But I was really interested in it because Kent County is showing some signs of being kind of like Oakland County lately, where you have large numbers of suburban voters with college degrees, higher incomes, and they are starting to vote more and more Democratic. We saw that especially in the 2018 midterm election. These are the kinds of voters Joe Biden seems to be doing well with. So I was interested to see, could the numbers Sanders put up 4 years ago there withstand this apparent Biden surge? And the answer was no. Biden actually won the county narrowly, very narrowly, but that he won a county that Bernie Sanders won by 23 points 4 years ago was really something.
Yeah, I don't know if you were following the returns in Livingston County. That's a place that was key to Alyssa Slotkin's congressional victory in the 8th District 2 years ago. But it looked like turnout was way up. What makes that happen in a traditionally conservative district?
Well, Livingston is it used to be maybe one of the two most Republican counties in the state. It's been a Republican bastion forever. And let's be clear, it's still a Republican bastion.
Mm-hmm.
However, it has lost some of that overwhelming Republican nature because, again, if you look around the Brighton area in particular, large numbers of voters with bachelor's degrees. You've also seen out-migration coming up I-96 as people move out from Southfield, Novi, Farmington Hills, moving out into Livingston County, and moving north from Ann Arbor, too. It's a real commuter area. So Livingston County, it's still a Republican county, make no mistake about it, but the days of it being, you know, the kind of county that puts up 70 to 75% of its vote for Republicans, that might be changing now.
Huh. I wanted to ask what you two think the Biden campaign needs to do next. Jonathan Kinloch, do you think there are ways that Joe Biden needs to evolve before November as the next phase of the election gears up?
Absolutely. One, he has to build an infrastructure. The way the campaign operated in this presidential primary period cannot be the same
with no money, right?
With no money and no real boots on the ground. I mean, there was really zero boots on the ground. So that is not what you're going to, imagine a winning campaign to look like come November. And of course, many of the unions and many of the organizations pretty much stood silent and did not endorse. In this primary, so you're going to, of course, have a lot of organizations, institutions, Democratic Party, doing huge GOTV efforts. So it will be totally different. But he has to stick on the message on pocketbook issues, and of course, we can't just totally depend upon the dislike and the era of Trump with what's going on in Washington. We have to have sound policies, sound issues, and stay focused on what conversations matter most to Michiganders. And right now, health care and affordable wages and like I said, pocketbook issues, that's what folks want to pretty much hear about.
Right. Zach Warchow, did you see Joe Biden's speech last night?
Well, I did not, but I certainly heard that it was very loud. Biden, I don't think anybody's going to confuse him with being a great orator. He gave a very good speech on Super Tuesday night, which I did see, which I thought was very enthusiastic. I thought you saw, the excitement of a candidate. This is his third time running, and he finally had, more than just South Carolina, to win so many states. He had a huge night, and that came through. But he has a tendency sometimes to confuse volume for enthusiasm. And, that's going to be a challenge for him. I mean, look, this is a guy who's been in politics for, four decades at least? So
right.
It's a little hard to change your ways. But in the end, I don't think anybody is going to vote for Joe Biden or not going to vote for Joe Biden or vote for Trump. Based on Joe Biden's oratorical style.
He was sounding kind of measured last night, but I guess we'll have to check back in and see if his tone changes through this time. Zach Warchow is executive editor and publisher of Gongwer News Service. Zach, thank you.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Jonathan Kinloch, chair of the 13th Congressional District for the Democratic Party. Jonathan, you take care.
Thank you.
As we continue to go over yesterday's election results, one of Michigan Radio's reporting projects decided to embed people in with one of the county clerks as the actual ballot count was going on. Will Callen is part of the 8th, the election project, looking specifically at voters in Michigan's 8th congressional district. Will, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Also with us is Matt Bernhard, a PhD candidate at the U of M, who studies cybersecurity and elections. Matt, nice to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you guys both spent the day at the Rochester Hills clerk's office. Will, why Rochester Hills? What was the choice about?
So Rochester Hills is going to be a very contested city in, you know, a battleground district and a battleground state. And Tina Barton, who's the clerk there, she's been really outspoken about the need to process absentee ballots a little bit earlier, possibly, because there's been a surge in the number. And I was talking with her on the phone the other week. She suggested that I volunteer for the counting board to see what it's like. And I don't know if she was expecting me to take her up on it, but I did.
You should never make a suggestion to a reporter. It's a good bet you're going to get taken up on it.
Yeah.
I mean, we should say, like, you weren't able to take any recording devices in with you or take notes on the process. But you two were just there to literally see how it works, right?
Yeah.
Well, what did you expect to see, and how would you say that matched up with what you experienced?
So because of the rise in absentee ballot applications and returns, I was expecting to be working pretty much nonstop, feeding ballots into the high-speed tabulators.
We kept hearing a lot about how the ballot preparation was expected to take a lot of time, too, just looking at the envelopes and making sure that voters are accounted for and getting the envelopes open would take time as well.
Yeah, and that did take a lot of time. I'd say that just watching the tables that were responsible for that part of the process, that was the slowest part. But Tina was treating the day as a dress rehearsal for the November election. So instead of using just two high-speed tabulators, which is probably all we needed, we used all four of them. And so the counting, once we had the ballots, went really quickly.
What time was it all finished?
It was finished by 10:30 p.m. because we still had to wait for the precincts to close at 8, at which point we took the lockbox where voters could drop off their absentee ballots and processed, you know, those final ones that had trickled in.
It sounds like it happened in batches, though.
It did happen in batches. We first worked with all the ballots that we had received leading up to Tuesday. I think that there were either two or three batches of kind of Dropbox ballots that were brought into us throughout the day.
10:30 is late, but compared with what we were hearing that it might take a couple of days to figure this out, it's not bad.
It's not terrible, but you gotta remember that I think the average age of a poll worker in Michigan is 76 years old, and so this is just a lot of repetitive, fatigue-inducing work. And, you know, the longer you're staring at paper like that, the greater room for error it gets.
Do you know the final number of how many absentee ballots were turned in?
Yeah, I think it was 8,930. So that's how many we received for yesterday. Tina is expecting there to be 20,000 in November.
For the general.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Bernhard, you volunteered too, and as we said, you're a PhD candidate at U of M's mm-hmm. Computer Science and Engineering Department. What were you there to watch for?
So I was serving as a troubleshooter. So if a precinct anywhere had a problem, you know, they didn't have a power strip, or they were out of voter applications, or they, you know, were confused about the poll book or anything like that, I was one of two runners who would go and try to debug their whatever was wrong. I would bring them supplies and so forth. Fortunately, because Tina runs such a tight ship, there were, you know, I sat on my hands for almost all of the election period. And then once the polls closed and the precincts came in, we had a couple of poll book discrepancies just because, you know, over a 13-hour period, it's easy to click the wrong button in the poll book. And so we helped kind of address those. And, you know, no voters were turned away that shouldn't have been. No voters voted that shouldn't have or anything like that. It was just a couple of, you know, last-minute checks that didn't quite line up that we had to massage.
In terms of election security, is there a difference between absentee voting and going to the polls? Is one more vulnerable than the other?
It's all a matter of trade-offs. Going to the polls has a lot of you know, it preserves anonymity a lot better. You know, if you're voting at home, you're subject to coercion by your spouse or your landlord or your boss or whoever. Going to the precinct doesn't really have that problem. Going to the precinct also has major improvements for accessibility. You know, if you're a voter with a disability, that doesn't change when you go home. So it's hard to, you know, if it's difficult for you to mark a paper ballot in the precinct, it's going to be difficult at home. But there are voting at home provides a lot of benefits, security and otherwise. You know, people can vote on a hand-marked paper ballot, which we, you know is the most secure way to vote. So it's all about trade-offs.
Will, any takeaways for what might be ahead for the general election?
Well, when comparing the number of absentee ballots on Tuesday to the number received in 2016, I think it was a 51% increase.
Wow.
And again, we only counted just under 9,000 yesterday. Tina's expecting 20,000 in November. So what I imagine is that there will be a lot less downtime on the counting board in November, which means a lot more fatigue and a lot more room for error, which, you know, and each thing that needs to be reconciled holds you up for more time.
Will Callen of the Michigan Radio Project, the 8th, looking at votes in Michigan's 8th Congressional District, and Matt Bernhardt, who is in the PhD program at U of M's Computer Science and Engineering Department. Guys, thank you so much. And do you think you might go back for the big count in November?
I think I might. Tina Barton is a it's going to be hard to say no to her.
So. Possibly, if I'm not sent elsewhere.
You can check out all the stories that the 8th is filing. They already have a few things for you to read if you go to the8th.michiganradio.org. Well, beginning today, you can go to a casino in Detroit and make online bets on sports events. We're talking to the president of MGM Grand Detroit about how that's going to work. Plus, far and wide, how far and wide will the spread of the novel coronavirus be? What kind of social disruption are we facing? That's all coming up on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The first legal sports betting in Michigan starts today, but you might have to go to a Detroit casino to do it. Michigan's Gaming Control Board has given these plans the thumbs up. Physical sports books will be open. Online and mobile sports wagering isn't going to start until next year. You might notice that online sports betting at tribal casinos near you are rolling out their plans individually. That's because they're not regulated by the state. David Tsai is president and COO of MGM Grand Detroit, and he joins us now to talk about his casino's plans. Mr. Tsai, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
Hey, I have to ask one thing out of the gate. Governor Whitmer just declared a health emergency for COVID-19. Do you think anybody's going to want to go to a casino to watch games and bet?
Well, we obviously this is a difficult time with everything going on. You know, I can't say we're taking a lot of precautionary measures to make sure that we're ensuring the safety of our guests, but we are still seeing guests coming to the casino. Certainly guests are still going about their lives, just hopefully are taking the right precautions as they do so.
As of this time, as we're having this conversation, there's no ban in gathering in public spaces.
That's correct.
Right. Well, let's talk about how this might work. I mean, I've been to sports books in Vegas. You go to a window to place your bet. There's a comfy room with big chairs and practically a two-story TV screen where you have a drink and hang out and watch a game. Is that what we can expect to see in spaces that you know of?
Absolutely. We will have what you have probably seen in other places, including Las Vegas. We have 6 betting windows where you can go up, speak with a cashier who can actually place your bet. We also have about 16 different kiosks located throughout the property where you can actually place a bet yourself if you would like. And as you mentioned, we have our BetMGM Sports Lounge. So we have 60 HDTVs, probably close to a 2-story video wall where you can watch any of your games, comfy chairs, craft cocktails, beers, all of that. So you really can not only place your bet with convenience, but also enjoy the game in a great environment.
What is this going to mean for sports fans who traditionally have just been doing sort of informal pools and betting?
As a company, we've been offering legal sports wagering for decades in Las Vegas, obviously, and we've since launched in Mississippi and New Jersey and other jurisdictions. You know, so we have a lot of experience offering sports wagering. We really believe this is a positive for guests who are interested in this product, right? We can now offer, ensure that there's integrity in the industry with betting. So now guests can actually bet in a safe environment, and now they can also do so in a great environment with other sports fans. So we actually think it's definitely a win.
How do the sports betting regulations in Detroit compare with what's going on across the river in Windsor?
Yeah, so my understanding is that in Windsor, you can actually only bet on parlay, so you're actually limited in the types of bets that you're able to offer. You know, we are able to offer the full range of bets that you would expect to see and that you do are able to make in other places as well, including Las Vegas. So not only parlay bets, which are bets where you're betting on multiple teams to win at the same time, you can make what we call straight bets, future bets, et cetera, most of the bets that a lot of our guests are interested in. So if you want to bet on your favorite team to win a particular game, you can do that here, but our understanding is that you can't do that in Windsor.
Well, I only ask because it looks like the Canadian Gaming Association and some others are asking members of parliament to tweak their existing laws to allow things like single game betting and in hopes of being a little bit more competitive, I'm assuming with Detroit.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, as you know, most of the jurisdictions which have now allowed legal betting are allowing the full range, the typical range that you would expect for bets. So certainly that would put Windsor at a competitive disadvantage by not offering, you know, essentially what our customers want. Luckily, we were able to do that. We were starting off offering live betting, and hopefully in less than a year, we'll be able to offer that on mobile devices and online, too.
MGM, as you mentioned, has pretty advanced operations in this area in Vegas and elsewhere. Is there a partner that you work with to help with the online aspect of this?
Yeah, there is. We actually entered into a joint venture with a company called GVC. They are a market leader. They've been providing sports betting and online gaming operations in Europe for a number of years. They have great technology that now we have access to. So through that joint venture partnership, that is how we are both operating our sports books now, as well as going to be offering future mobile and online gaming. That joint venture partnership is called Roar, and we use a technology platform there. It's called Stadium.
Right. So what do you have planned for your first bet event today?
We're really excited. This has been a long time coming. There's been a lot of hard work being done to prepare for this, but we are happy that we are having a number of folks who will be joining us for this. So we have Mayor Mike Duggan, Mayor of Detroit here, who's going to be here to help commemorate the occasion. He's going to help us do some provide some remarks. And we also have a number of exciting first bettors here with us, too, just to help us commemorate. So we have a number of local Detroit celebrities who will be here to help us. Dino Cicciarelli, who's obviously with the Detroit Red Wings, Dave Rosema with the Detroit Tigers, Tommy Hearns, a Detroit boxer. We're really excited to really make sure that we can celebrate what sports is all about and really ring in what we think is a historic occasion for Detroit and for Michigan.
Has the rise of online gaming provided some challenges in terms of figuring out what kind of experience a casino can provide? I mean, the whole history of the industry is so tied into, personal experiences with poker, with slots, sometimes with blackjack. But the experience of placing a bet and sitting and watching a game, technically anyone can do that at home online if they wish, legally or illegally. But has this changed the game in terms of how you think about what MGM has to offer?
I think if anything, it's probably expanded the way we think about it. I mean, we currently already have both live and online gaming available in New Jersey, and we have a property there, the Borgata, where we've also experienced this evolution. And as you know, this has been going on for many years also overseas in Europe. I think it really comes down to offering guests more options. Obviously, we live in a digital age where, more and more channels are available to our customers. So I think that the customers who want to bet online or on their phone and the comfort of their home and stay at home and watch the game, they will now be able to do so. But we also continue to find that a lot of customers want to come to a central location, place their bet with a live person, and then sit in a great sports bar and watch the game and be able to cheer their favorite teams with a bunch of fellow fans and want to stay there and then place additional bets as well. They want that kind of in-person live dynamic experience. We're excited for this. I mean, we've always found that when we can offer more amenities for our guests, but do it in a protected and regulated way, it really is a win-win. I mean, not only does it provide the safety of being able to bet with with a renowned and with a well-regulated environment, but ultimately our goal is to provide entertainment and make sure people have a good time. Now we're able to do that, and then obviously it generates great tax revenue for the city and for the state. And we're just fortunate and happy to be part of that.
David Tsai, President and COO of MGM Grand Detroit, thank you for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, April.
My next guest is a top expert in the history of infectious disease. He says he does not feel fearful about COVID-19, but he says there's plenty to learn from the new coronavirus about how decisions are made in outbreaks. Dr. Howard Markel is an award-winning and New York Times bestselling author and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Dr. Markel, welcome back to Stateside.
Great to be here.
We have a coworker here at Michigan Radio who actually remembers back in the day being put on the bus with a bunch of other kids and taken for polio vaccine.
Sure.
When we think about testing on a massive scale, I mean, obviously Michigan isn't there yet, but what should massive response look like?
Well, massive response should be to take a breath and realize that this is a serious public health issue, but 35,000 to 65,000 Americans will die of influenza this year. 300 to 400 people died of AIDS in the past hour and in the next hour and so on. So while this is serious, I don't think mass testing of all people is feasible economically or even, epidemiologically. But you try to avoid getting sick if you can, and if you are sick, stay at home. And if you need medical care because you're having trouble breathing or what have you, then you need to see a physician very quickly.
We're starting to see K through 12 schools alter mm-hmm. their activities, universities canceling face-to-face instruction and planned activities, conference travel, of course. The mass disruption, does it feel like we're getting closer to what that would look like?
It does, and that's a great term, the mass disruption. We tend not to unfold these social distancing strategies like school closure unless they're needed and we tend to unroll these social distancing strategies when the threat of real danger and death is greater than the risk of social disruption. Because it's not just kids staying at home, it's parents staying at home with their children. Not everyone has a job where they can just take time off. There are parents who are hourly workers, and we should not put them in the position of having to choose between paying their rent or taking care of their children. We have to take care to make sure those people are not being penalized at the job or in the paycheck. So there's a lot of issues here. This is really the nuclear option, if you will, of public health tools. So we use it very gingerly and hopefully very carefully.
This is all evolving, and we don't have super firm numbers about how many people may have the coronavirus right now.
Right.
But one gets the sense that Governor Whitmer and the State Health Department are trying to talk about social distancing just to stop the spread.
Yes.
So we can figure out
Yes.
where the hot spots are. Where does this end? I mean, how do health officials make decisions
Yeah.
about when people can start gathering in large spaces
Right.
again and just resuming normal work?
Yeah, well, we're really flying by the seat of our pants here because we have a novel coronavirus that we have no previous experience with, and we don't have the best data that we would like until long after the threat has probably subsided. So Governor Whitmer, I think, has given a lot of health officers cover by declaring a state emergency, and now they will have to decide individually based on whether or not there are cases in their communities, in their counties, or in their schools of whether to pull that trigger. You know, the goal of these strategies is not to end coronavirus, but to flatten the epidemiological curve, reduce the onslaught of people coming to hospitals and health clinics, and then hopefully reduce the number of cases and deaths until you can develop some better strategies, treatments, and so on.
How should institutions and maybe just even the average small business owner make their own decisions about whether or not they're going to stop what they're doing?
I think now is a very good time for bosses to have conversations with their employees. I just had one with my employees about what we're going to do if that trigger is pulled. And I think it's really important to tell people if you're sick or your children are sick, stay home. And you can help them if you're an employer by making sure they don't suffer with the paycheck. And the federal government, frankly, could help too. There's that $8.4 billion that's being used for coronavirus work. Well, we've been talking about people having a paid sick leave, if you will, or a paid parental sick leave in the event of a contagious crisis. And this is certainly one of those.
I was thinking about how much our definitions about fast response have changed. between the epidemics that you've studied and covered and what's unfolding right now? I mean, technology has made it possible for us to almost keep up with the spread of disease if only our institutions could decide what information they were going to put out over technology. How do you think about what's, you know, how the flow of information should work right now?
Well, it is an epidemic at warp speed. The way it travels, it can travel in jet planes as opposed to steamships. And the information is good and bad. Good information, I think, is always good. And it has helped scientists around the world get a much better handle on this virus at a much faster point than any other in history. At the same time, there is so much media, there are so many sources that the hype, I feel, is more virulent right now than the virus itself. And so that's a problem that we have to handle as communicators, as educators, as doctors and health officials to assure the people of Michigan and beyond that things are at hand and we can do this. We can take care of this.
Is it better to be fast or to have a plan?
It's better to be both. We should have had plans in place long before this actually started in terms of pandemic preparedness, and a lot of us have been working on these issues since at least bird flu in 2005. But you do have to act fast with these community mitigation strategies because once the virus hits an inflection point, which we don't know what that is right now, it is circulating throughout the community and the cases are going to happen. And in fact, we studied school closures in the state of Michigan during the 2009 flu pandemic, and we studied about 550 school districts. 83% were reactive, acted too late, and guess what? It didn't have an effect on the circulation of flu in those communities. So too late is not good. I would err on too early. You know, the history of public health officers is littered with officers who have either made the call too early and then people complain, or too late and then people either get sick or die.
It's like snow closures.
Yes. I would argue as a pediatrician, I never had a parent tell me my advice is better to be safe than sorry. They never came back and said, hey, doc, I want my money back. So I would, you know, when it comes to our children and our health, I would act quickly and roll it back rather than too late.
You know, I just wonder, there are communities in the state where you could imagine people working remotely and schools being shutting down their face-to-face interactions for some time and it not really having that much effect. But I just think of a town like Flint, where people are so close to the edge economically.
Yeah.
And what a cessation of daily work life would mean in a place like that.
Oh, it'd be a disaster. And that's why we have to have some type of social network netting under those people. And, you know, another issue is that when we studied this back in 1918, there were even then children, for example, in Chicago who were considered to be so at risk for their home lives. There was abuse and other things that were going on. That school was a safer place than being at home. Or what if you're a homeless child? There are over 100,000 homeless students in the New York City Public School District. Well, school is the safest haven for those kids. So it's all a balancing act, and you try to do your best with all of these factors. And the good news is we're far more aware and willing to entertain or take care of these issues than our predecessors 100 years ago, where quarantine was just about getting those sick people away from us. We not only care for those who are sick or quarantined, but we are taking care or trying to attempt to take care of these social issues that are pressing upon us.
Howard, you're the expert on this kind of stuff. Are we to the point where any of it is keeping you up at night?
Well, it's keeping me up at night because I'm trying to keep up with the information. But it's not keeping me up at night that this is the great pandemic that will, you know, kill us and all. No, not at all. You know, let's get a handle. There are over 100,000 cases and over 4,500 deaths. That's serious. And for those who have died, that's a tragedy. But this is not something that we have to fear. It is something we have to have legitimate concern and take action against.
Dr. Howard Markell is director for the Center of the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
One final note about tomorrow's show. In 2016, the Democratic blue wall crumbled in the presidential election. Politico's Tim Alberta wasn't surprised. He'd written about the possibility months earlier.
I will hang my hat on that one article, but like so many other people, I think there were other just fundamentally important things that I missed along the way in 2016.
Chief correspondent for Politico, Michigan native Tim Alberta is our guest on the next Stateside. Till then, I'm April Baer. Stay safe out there. We'll see you tomorrow.